All right. Once again, decisions. That's what we're going for here. We're going for decisions. And we're going to be examining decisions that are made all over the world. And I'm really, really looking forward to this show. And back at the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Jonathan Berger and Van Anvo, who were involved with the Kronos Quartet's production of My Lai, the story of the infamous 1968 massacre of 500 Vietnamese people in the village of My Lai by American soldiers. And it's just, I recently saw the opera, and it just blew my mind. So I'm really looking forward to talking with them about that. And opening the show up, I'm really pleased to have this person back to the show because it's been way too long. His name is Miko Peled, and we're going to be talking with him about Israel's incremental genocide against the Palestinian people. He's the author of the book The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, and Injustice, the story of the Holy Land Foundation. And Miko was born in Jerusalem in 1961 into a well-known Zionist family. He is a writer and human rights activist born and raised in Jerusalem, and he calls for justice in Palestine, support of the Palestinian, call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and the creation of a single democracy with equal rights on all of historic Palestine. Miko, welcome back to the show, man. It's been a while.
Thank you. It's great to be with you again.
Yeah, definitely, man. Well, let's jump into this because I want to get as much in as we can. There's a full-scale assault on the Palestinian people right now that a lot of people don't even know about because it's kept quiet and secret from the rest of the world. In February alone, at least 1,319 Palestinian people were detained by the Israeli occupation forces, and other assaults continue unmitigated. Yet so little is known to the rest of the world. What's your assessment of the situation today?
It's funny, you know, because people always say to me, so how are things in Palestine? It seems like it's really nice and quiet there now, like nothing's going on. And I'm thinking, how in the world does anybody reach that conclusion? What in the world makes people think that everything is fine? Palestine is bleeding like an injured human being, bleeding to death at an unbelievable speed, It's a miracle that there's any piece of Palestine that is still alive. It has required now enormous efforts, enormous relief, to just bring Palestine back on its feet. And that relief isn't anywhere, you know, anywhere in sight. And so the patient is dying very rapidly. The bleeding is severe. And like you said, people go around the world thinking that everything's fine because they don't see it on the news.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this, though. Like, when you look at this, they're bleeding. There's a lot of assaults on the Palestinian people. But this actually, from individual assaults, I mean, to me, it really does look like basically what we're looking at is ethnic cleansing. And that, to me, raises things to a whole other level, cleansing the Palestinians from Jerusalem, but also other aspects of this throughout the country as a whole.
Yes, you know, it's interesting, too, because when you use terms like ethnic cleansing, like genocide, like describing the Israel's regime as an apartheid regime, people on the other side, you know, they're always up in arms. They're going, you know, they're outraged. How dare you say the Jews could possibly commit genocide? The Jews would ever agree to impose apartheid on other people? I think Nancy Pelosi once said, it's absurd to think that Jews would ever, you know, use apartheid against other people. First of all, Jews are like any other people. They can do what other people do. They're just as bad and just as good. But on the issue of Palestine, it's very easy to show because the international community has defined these terms. What is happening in Palestine is all of the above. It's an apartheid regime. And again, the international law describes exactly what apartheid is. It is ethnic cleansing. And again, you can look at the definition of ethnic cleansing. And it's genocide. And it's very, look at the Geneva Convention, the description of the crime of genocide, and compare these three definitions to what has been happening in Palestine over the last 7 decades. And somebody come up here and tell me that it is not a perfect fit. It is genocide, it is ethnic cleansing, and it's a regime of apartheid, all at the same time. All at the same time. And again, the definitions are very clear. So for somebody to come up and say, oh, no, it's not this, it's not that, it's not the other, is complete nonsense. All you have to do is look at the definitions that international law has given these terms, these crimes, and it's a perfect fit.
Mm-hmm. Let's get into some concrete examples of what actually is happening in Palestine now.
Well, we have 2 million people in the Gaza Strip without access to clean water, without access to proper medical care. They have been subjected to bombing beyond belief, and the injured from those bombings still have not been able to get medical relief. We're talking about tens of thousands of people without access to relief. Now, if you want to make sure to kill, if you want to kill someone without shooting them, you can injure them and then let them die slowly, or you can deny them water, or you can deny them clean water and they will die from disease. So there's clearly an attempt here, a very clear intent to see the people of Gaza die a slow death. And we're talking about 2 million people. And we know very well, as a result of organizations, relief organizations that are able to do some work there, that a child with a curable disease, with a curable cancer inside the Gaza Strip will die. And a child, a Jewish Israeli child, a mile away on the other side of the border with the exact same disease will live. And it's only because Israel denies the health care, the proper medical care to the child, the Palestinian child. So that's 2 million people in the Gaza Strip. We have hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in the Negev desert who are denied clean water. We have infant mortality rates that are off the chart and have no, without even any comparison to mortality rates among Israeli Jews. And we're talking about the Bedouins in the Negev desert, Palestinians or Israeli citizens. Children are dying because they have no access to clean water. So they're admitted to the hospital with diseases that you never see Israeli children, Jewish children being admitted with these diseases. They don't have those problems. They have access to clean water. They have access to healthcare immediately. We have Palestinians in Jerusalem who are losing their homes at an alarming rate, losing the right to live there. You know, I was born and raised in Jerusalem. I can come and go as I please. I've been gone for 20 years. You know, I go back. I'm a citizen. Palestinians in Jerusalem are, first of all, they're not citizens. They're alien residents, even though some of the families there go back to the days of Salah ad-Din. And if they leave, they lose their ability to return. They lose their alien resident status, and their property is taken away. And this is happening at an alarming rate, plus home demolition, plus entire communities in the periphery of Jerusalem, which used to be attached to Jerusalem, Palestinian communities, Palestinian towns, in the Kalandia, Bir Nabala, Aram, that have become ghost towns, complete ghost towns. You know, you see the brand new buildings, businesses, homes, completely abandoned because the people were subjected to ethnic cleansing. And the list goes on and on and on. In the Galilee, in other parts, every part of the country, Palestinians are suffering from a regime of apartheid, a campaign of ethnic cleansing, and genocide all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. You know, and the thing is that's so enraging, too, is that it is so pushed underneath everything else. So people, a lot of people don't know about it at all, you know, and they look at it and they think, oh, well, you know, things are going well there. There's talks, going on. There's all this kind of stuff happening. And actually, in reality, there's something, when I look at it, I was thinking about this last night, you know, really, Gaza in particular actually really reminds me of the Warsaw Ghetto. And there's a certain irony there, given who's actually, you know, reigning over what's happening in Gaza right now. But the fact that it does look like and remind one of the Warsaw Ghetto is pretty heavy.
Yes, it's horrifying. It's beyond horrifying. You know, the fact that the world is allowing that to happen, and again, we're not talking about some remote mountaintop, I don't know, in the middle of Afghanistan where there's no access. We're talking about Palestine. We're talking about a country where there's plenty of access, or there could be plenty of access to clean water, to the best health care. People are educated. You know, it's a three-hour flight from Paris. I mean, for God's sakes, I mean, you can't get, you know, it's a half an hour from Tel Aviv, from Jerusalem, cities where you wouldn't dream of seeing Israeli Jews live like this. Mm-hmm. And nobody cares. There are no protests. There are no demands that this siege on Gaza be stopped. If this is any other place, you would have the Sixth Fleet there forcing the siege open and giving basic humanitarian care to the people there. But they won't do that because it's Israel. But that's really what needs to happen. The Sixth Fleet needs to force that siege open instead of collaborating with the state of Israel, which is what the U.S. Military is doing now on a huge scale, and allow for some relief, a basic relief for the 2 million people in Gaza. And by the way, the crime of genocide, as it is defined by the Geneva Convention, also speaks about complicity with genocide. And that's where the United States government and the European government are hopefully will one day find themselves in a court of law because they are complicit with the genocide of the Palestinians.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Miko Peled, activist and author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine and Injustice, the story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. And actually, and this is something I wanted to get into deeply for the next, probably for the remainder of the interview, but there's a specific role of U.S. imperialism here. You know, and you look at this in all these different ways, and it's been in particular, it's been ongoing, but in particular, it's taken a leap since the ascendancy of Trump to the top of the regime. You know, you look at, for instance, just the recent thing with Jerusalem and the U.S. Embassy and the U.S. Embassy being moved to Jerusalem, which is more than just sort of like a matter of convenience. It's actually a declaration that the U.S. stands solidly behind the genocide that the Israeli administration and government is putting forward and are bringing down on the Palestinian people.
Yes, without a doubt. Trump has emboldened Israel in a way that was hard to imagine because we all thought that, you know, this is as bad as it's going to get. And this move was, first of all, reckless, but it was also a move that was designed as a slap in the face to all the Arab and Muslim world, as a personal political gift to Benjamin Netanyahu, because Netanyahu and Trump have become BFFs. And now they brought into the equation the new crown prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, who is a criminal, who is conducting a horrifying campaign of killing and slaughter in Yemen, and has just been given, you know, billions of dollars worth of weapons by the Brits, and, you know, a complete license to continue with this by the Americans. And what he has to do in order to, you know, the price that he has to pay is, of course, normalized relations with Israel, and I think it's fully, we have every reason to expect that there will be normal and diplomatic relations between the two countries before long. So this is a very dangerous time. I think it's more dangerous than anything I've ever seen in my lifetime. And the people who suffer the most as a result of this are the Palestinians, because this the fact that Israel has been emboldened, they are even more violent and more brutal towards Palestinians and Palestinian children than they've ever been before.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just look at the fact that they're cutting the funds to the United Nations Relief and Work Agency, and the impact of that, that's going to have is horrendous.
Yeah. Well, the thing is with that is, fine, you want to stop funding the UNRWA, fine. But the second half of that needs to be, the second part, allow the refugees to go home. These 5 million refugees do not want the UN money. They do not want the UN schools. They do not want the handouts. They do not want to live in refugee camps. They're perfectly happy to go back home tomorrow morning. But Israel, of course, has banned them and won't allow them to return. So you can't deny them the funds, the minimal scrap, you know, these are scraps really that they're getting, and then say, well, you're going to have to die. Let them go home. Let them go home, and I'm sure they'll be very happy not to have these handouts from the United Nations. Mm-hmm. You can't do one without the other.
Well, tell me this, you know, because one of the things that I think is really important for people to understand and to understand very clearly, and this was on exhibit at the recent AIPAC convention back in D.C., and I know you're there now, so I'm sure you have some thoughts on it, whether you were there or not, but the fact that Schumer's AIPAC speech, I mean, here's the guy who is like, you know, people are always talking about, oh, the Democrats, they'll save the day, they'll save the day. Here's the guy that's in charge of the Democrats. And look at the fascistic speech he gave at the AIPAC gathering. You know, and you think about this, this is really very heavy. I mean, he was basically saying the Palestinians, who needs them? Let's get rid of them.
Yeah, the Palestinians, the Iranians, you know, these are the scapegoats now. You know, they're the scapegoats du jour. And both his speech, Mike Pence's speech, were really the preludes to Netanyahu's speech. And Netanyahu's speech, of course, lays out, you know, U.S. foreign policy, which means that the bombing and the destruction of Iraq and Syria is allowed to continue. The bombing by bin Salman in Saudi Arabia of the Yemenites must continue. The bombing and the genocide in Gaza must continue. And all of this because of Iran, which has nothing to do with any of this. Oh, and also the destabilization of Lebanon. So he mentioned all of these countries as the arms of a dark empire, and that dark empire is Iran. He's out of his mind. Iran is a country that's never attacked, never occupied, never bothered anyone, but they dare to stand with the Palestinians. They won't be bought like the Saudis and the Jordanians and the Egyptian regimes, which have completely thrown the Palestinians under the bus. They stand up and they stand with the Palestinians, and they stand firmly against against Zionism and the Zionist regime in Palestine, you know, 110%. And for that, they need to be, you know, they need to be brought down and they need to be described as the enemy. That is the reality. And of course, that speech by Netanyahu really set the tone for U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East.
Well, you know, I want to pursue the other end of that, too, just as well, because I think it's important that people understand that the U.S. is actually, I mean, look, basically, I believe that the country, the system that's running, actually running the show in Israel and overseeing what's happening, what's being done to Palestine, is actually, and to the Palestinians, does have a lot to do with, and I think it is the U.S. imperialists. And when you look at this, I want people to realize this, that this is what Schumer, all this stuff that's being done that you've been talking about, all this stuff that's being done has been done with the nod of approval from all facets of the U.S. ruling structures. And Schumer, recently speaking at the AIPAC convention, he said, the fact of the matter is that too many Palestinians and too many Arabs do not want any Jewish state in the Middle East. And it says, of course, we say it's our land. The Torah says it. But they don't believe in the Torah. So that's the reason there is not peace. They invent other reasons, but they don't believe in a Jewish state. And that's why we in America must stand strong with Israel through thick and thin. Right. What do you think of that?
Suddenly Schumer became a Hasid. You know, Schumer suddenly became a rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi. He cares about the Torah. Suddenly he cares about the Torah. Does he eat kosher and everything else as well and not drive on the Shabbat? I mean, this is complete nonsense and hypocrisy. It's a complete hypocrisy. He's probably the biggest buffoon to ever set foot in Washington, D.C., Chuck Schumer. He also said that the BDS is some kind of a new form of anti-Semitism. But this idea that, first of all, it's perfectly understandable that Arabs and Palestinians do not want a Jewish state in Palestine. Nobody would want a foreign state in their land. So that's perfectly understandable. There's nothing wrong with that. It has nothing to do with the Torah. And by the way, the real Torah Jews, the most ultra-Orthodox communities in Jerusalem, in New York, and in London, and so forth, are completely opposed to the Jewish state. And the Orthodox Jews who do follow the Torah, who do keep kosher, who do observe the Shabbat, you know, Shabbos, the holy day, all oppose the state of Israel and have opposed Zionism and oppose any kind of Jewish sovereignty in Palestine and have done so for over 100 years. So suddenly, Chuck Schumer thinks he's a rabbi and he's going to, he's going to use the Torah as an excuse to kill Palestinians and allow Israel to continue. It's racism, it's violence, and it's lies. These are the three things upon which the state of Israel exists: racism, violence, and lies to justify the racism and the violence. And of course, Chuck Schumer has brought it to a whole new level of absurd.
Mm-hmm. And absurd, and it's really dangerous too. In terms of the escalation of the assault on the Palestinian people. I mean, I really think people here need to pay attention to what's happening there and to look at like what's the reality of this. Because even when you mentioned Pence before, and if you have some brief things to say on that, because I think it's important that people understand. Pence, on the other hand, you have Chuck Schumer in there talking about this is all based in Judaism and this is our destiny, and then you have, you know. You have Pence coming in and Pence being a born again Christian fascist who's actually out there really, promoting that whole sense of like, this is something we need to do. And he's, you know, he went on a long tour. He had, you know, he backed up the Israeli regime tremendously. He's another big player in there that people have to actually recognize that this person is part of a whole big process that's designed to do ethnic cleansing and the elimination of the Palestinian people as a people.
Yep, and he is, you know, he's the entire brass band of Zionism. You know, he's out there blowing the horns and tooting and you know, and by the way, you just briefly in the introduction, you mentioned my new book, Injustice. In the case of the Holy Land Foundation, which was the largest Muslim charity here in America, and did wonderful things and kept stay out of politics and did not support any factions, political or terrorist or military or anything like that, Chuck Schumer, along with Anthony Weiner and Elliot Spitzer and a few others, they began to undermine the Holy Land Foundation in the early 90s, and they began spreading rumors along with the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, saying that somehow this charity, which was creating alliances and working with all relief organizations around the world and getting very high ratings and doing incredibly important work, we're somehow diverting funds and funneling funds to terrorist organizations. They were the ones who were behind it. So they took a perfectly legitimate organization that was providing relief to Palestinians And they were conflating that with terrorism because they wanted to bring them down just because they're Palestinians. In other words, Palestinians do not have a right even to relief here in this country without being somehow conflated with terrorism. And of course, today, five good men, are innocent men, are sitting in federal prison as a result of this. So there's no end to this draconian, you know, this draconian perspective that Schumer and all these others bring to the table.
All right, and I want to leave you with one more thing here, and then we're going to have to wrap up. But people should also know that other people that spoke along the same lines as Chuck Schumer included House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat of California, all Democrats, by the way, Senator Ben Cardin from Maryland, Senator Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota, and Representative Adam Schiff from California. They all spoke before the conference this week. And not one of the people, not one of these big Democratic leaders addressing the conference could bring themselves to even think about speaking about the occupation of Palestine or the discrimination and the actual campaign against the Palestinian people to wipe the Palestinian people out. That sort of says a whole lot.
No, of course not. If they talked about that, then they wouldn't be in AIPAC. AIPAC is the lobby for racism, violence, and lies. And at least talk about the McCollum bill. In other words, there is a bill in Congress that talks about at least sparing the children, at least not allowing Israel to arrest and torture and detain children, at least follow international law on that one small aspect of Palestinian life, make the children. And even that, none of these guys are willing to sponsor or co-sponsor or support the McCollum bill, which is the first time this sort of thing has even been brought up in the House of Representatives. But no, they don't care about the children. They don't care about anything.
All right, Mika Peled, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
All right, and we'll look forward to talking to you again, man. Take care.
Take care. You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Mika Peled. And Mika Peled is an author and an activist. He's the author of The General's Son and Injustice. He was born in Jerusalem in 1961 to a well-known Zionist family, and he has spent the better part of his life as a writer and a human rights activist and a fighter against what's being done to the Palestinian people, the attempt to eliminate the Palestinian people from the face of the earth. All right, we're going to take a minute and listen to a piece called Supremacy, a new piece by Roger Waters and Le Trio Joubran. This is a response to Trump declaring that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, and it is based on an excerpt from an epic poem by the great Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish.
A long time must go by before our present becomes history, just like us. We will face the long march, but first we will defend the trees we wear. We will defend the bell of night and the hanging moon over our huts. We will defend the leaping deer and the clay of our pots, and the eagle feathers in the wings of our final song. But soon you will erect your world on our remains. You will pave over the sacred places to open a road to the satellite moon. This is the age of industry. The age of coal, fossils to fuel your thirst for fine wine. There are the dead. And the settlements, the dead, and the bulldozers, the dead, and the hospitals. There are radar screens to capture the dead who die more than once in this life. To capture the dead who walk off to death, the dead who breed the beast of civilization. After all the relics are gone, where, O white master, are you taking my people and yours?
That was Supremacy by Roger Waters and Le Trio Joubran. All right, right now, I want to actually move into something that I think is extremely important. It's something that when we're looking at the world today and what we have to do today and what's confronting us, we have to look for the resources that can actually help us understand what's happening, why it's happening, and What are we going to do about it? All right. And so for the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be playing pieces from a film that Bob Avakian made. It's an incredibly important film. It's called The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the Name of Humanity, We Refuse to Accept the Fascist America, A Better World is Possible, a talk by Bob Avakian. We're going to take the opening question from that speech, that talk. There's an opening question, an opening comment and question that I think is really important. And you can find this, by the way, you can find this for yourself. If you're listening to it and you want to find more, go to revcom.us and you can find it right there and check it out. But we are going to be running this because this is what we need in the world today. So check this out.
So here's the first question for you. All set?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So what do you say to the late night comedians, the Stephen Colberts, et cetera, who do some powerful humor and ridicule, but also run the risk of becoming like court jesters, and in this case, contributing to the normalization of fascism?
First of all, free yourself from the GTF. That's the first thing I say. Because with all of their, you know, outrage against many of the Trump things, when it comes to, you know, I'm reminded of the Phil Oak song, Love Me, I'm a Liberal. You know, when it comes to times like Korea, there's no one more red, white, and blue. And that this is a big problem with these liberal critics, is they share a lot of the American chauvinist assumptions. You know, people feel obligated to say things like, you know, now I'm switching from late night host to LeBron James, you know. Even when he's standing up against Trump, he feels obliged to say, maybe even believes it, you know, this is the greatest country in the world. No, it's f***ing not, okay? So, you know, that's the first thing, you know. Get up off that, you know. Get up off that. Now, you know, maybe he actually, you know, look, he occupies, or Colbert or the rest of them, they occupy certain position where they make a lot of money, and maybe from where they're sitting, they precisely have the view that, well, there are a lot of things wrong in this country, but after all, people like me have been able to get to this position. So, you know, it is correct to unite with people broadly, including these people, and encourage them to deepen their criticism of, you know, what Trump is about. Don't normalize. Don't, you know, you listen to CNN or even MSNBC or whatever, and what do they start? For a while, they would talk about Trump, Trump, Trump. Now, you notice all of a sudden, it's the president, the president, the president. This is a way of normalizing things for people, that even when you're criticizing Trump, even, you know, raising serious disagreements or saying he lacks the quality of a president or whatever, you know, all those things are at the same time helping to normalize things, because if you keep hammering the president, the president, the president, well, you know, that goes along with the idea, well, we're stuck with this for another however many, 3+ years, you know, and there's nothing we can do about it. And that is the idea that we have to take on and struggle against. And people who, like, you know, for example, like I referred to Paul Krugman, people like that who've made statements that are true, that what we have here is a regime of people that could bring an end to civilization and even to human existence, then you have to follow through on what you've said. You know, that's an important statement from a prominent person. So follow through. What's the logic? The logic is we can't afford to normalize this. We can't afford to allow this person and this regime to stay in power, you know, and to do whatever it is they're going to do, because one thing is clear, is they forge ahead with doing what they're going to do. If they get a defeat legislatively, if there's, you know, opposition there, they do it by executive decree, essentially. So, you know, it's necessary for people to break out of normalizing things, and it's very important to struggle with people broadly. You know, look, you might want America to be a great country, you know, you might want it to play a positive role in the world, but you've got to face the reality. See, one of the big critiques of Trump is that he has no respect for the truth. And all of a sudden, it's interesting, because all on campuses and everywhere, up until Trump came along, there was overwhelming dominance among even people with better, you know, inclinations of the, you know, relativism of the identity politics, that there is no actual truth, that they're just different narratives, and different people all have their different narratives, and no one can challenge anybody else's narrative. Then along comes Trump, and all of a sudden, a lot of people are saying, wait a minute, the truth matters. You know, because Trump is so, you know, egregiously and blatantly, stomping on the truth and trampling the truth. And, just overtly, and deliberately, people will call him out and say, well, you said this and it's not true. A lot of people believe that. Well, that's exactly, if you want to get right, let's get down with it. You know, that's exactly the argument of a lot of identity politics. A lot of people believe that. Well, is it true or not true? What does the evidence actually show? You know, is America a great country or is it not? What does the historical evidence and what does a present-day reality actually show? Well, you know, it's probably not going to be immediately that people like Colbert or others who are criticizing Trump are going to break with all, you know, their belief in America as a great country. And while we should continue to struggle wherever we can with people about that, at the same time, we should unite with them wherever they do take positive steps or do positive things and encourage them to go further and do more. You know, that is very important. You know, Trump, this, by the way, I just want to take a second to speak. Trump is very calculating. People say, oh, he doesn't know what he's doing. You know, he's an idiot. You know, he is a kind of a maniac. That's true. But he's a calculating one. And he is approaching things strategically. When he got up and said what he said about the players in the NFL, you know, basically at a Ku Klux Klan rally in Alabama, let's just tell it like it is, okay? You know, that's another thing. I'm sorry, I keep diverting myself. But this thing about, here's another normalization technique. Well, when Trump says these things, he's just appealing to his base. Well, that's a way of normalizing it. See, instead of saying he's just trying to, incite a bunch of fascists, you say he's just trying to appeal to his base. So that makes it somehow legitimate, you see. His base is an electoral base. That we have an electoral system, so naturally he appeals to his base. It's a way of subtly and insidiously, you know, in a sneaky way, normalizing all this by saying, well, he's just appealing to his base. Well, what's the content of what he's saying? What's the content of that, you see? So all these are things that normalize. So when Trump, but going back to the NFL thing, when he said this about the players, that was very calculating. He and Pence are working on actually getting these players to be cowed, because this is this is a very important form of resistance that these players are taking. And by the way, let's tell the truth again. All these people on MSNBC and even CNN and all these assorted liberals who are trying to separate out the protest of the players from the question of patriotism and the flag are lying. Go back. I mean, maybe some of the players, you know, there's differences among them and different understanding of viewpoint. But go back to Colin Kaepernick's original statement. Why should I stand up for a flag and support a country that's murdering black people and other people of color? What is that statement? Yeah. He's directly saying, I'm not going to be patriotic to a country where this is what goes on all the time. That's the essence of what he said. But so, you know, on the other hand, there are other people who have a less, you know, advanced understanding. I mean, I have to say, it took me back 50 years and, you know, warmed my heart when I saw Colin Kaepernick with a T-shirt of that iconic picture. I guess some of you are familiar with of Huey Newton in the chair. You know, and it really warmed my heart to see that. It reminded me of the days when people were standing up against all this, you know, and we need a lot more of that. But at the same time, I mentioned LeBron James. Okay, you know, LeBron, you took a good stand. You know, you called the president a bum. That's a good thing to do, you know. And well deserved and more. But, you know, we also, you know, so we shouldn't have a contemptuous, disdainful attitude toward people whose opposition is only partial. We should unite with them. At the same time, we should struggle with them to go further. And even when they don't go further in the short run, we should still seek to bring out the positive and unite with that, recognizing this is, look, I'm coming from where I'm coming from. You know, I put it out to you. You know, I'm not hiding it. I would never want to hide it. It's what I think is needed in the world. But, you know, we're also working and uniting with other people in Refuse Fascism. We need organizations like Refuse Fascism to very quickly become massive organizations where overwhelmingly the people in it do not agree with where I'm coming from and where our party is coming from. Otherwise, it's not going to accomplish what it's going to accomplish. So we can't have a narrow sectarian attitude toward people who stand up but don't do it absolutely on the terms we want them to do it on. So we have to have a very broad, you know, broad arms to encompass and embrace a lot of different people coming from a lot of different places while we have honest, and I'll use that word, comradely struggle about what is the problem here and what is the solution, what needs to be done immediately, and what needs to be done in an overall more fundamental sense. Our analysis of our party is that, yes, we're for revolution. That's what's necessary. That's what we're working for every day. But right now, that revolution has to go through a massive movement to drive out this fascist regime, or else the prospect for revolution or anything positive are going to be monumentally set back. So that's the approach we have to have. Those of us who are communists should be openly talking to people about that. Those of us who think there's some other solution, we should be discussing all that among ourselves while we're uniting broadly to deal with this immediate, and very dangerous and potentially disastrous situation. So the Colberts, we should be criticizing them. Go further, Yes, break with that American chauvinism, but meanwhile, keep doing what you're doing and do it better.
Okay.
All right. Welcome back. That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And it was one of the questions asked him at a talk he gave a while back about the Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. A talk by Bob Avakian. And it was given shortly before the November demonstrations calling for the whole regime to go that were going on around the country. And basically, if you want to access that entire film right away, go to revcom.us. You'll see it there very prominently. All right. Now we're going to hear from composer Jonathan Berger and musician Van Anvo, who were both part of the Kronos Quartet's opera My Lai. And I'd like to start off with an audio clip from the opera called Lullaby, which features Van Anvo playing a traditional Vietnamese instrument. All right, that song was Lullaby from the Kronos Quartet's opera My Lai, which featured Van Anvo on a traditional Vietnamese instrument. I recently saw something that was really unique for me, and I have to say it was something that really just blew me away. I've never seen an opera. I've never been to an opera until last Friday. When I saw the one that was out at UCLA, it's called My Lai, And it's an incredibly powerful opera. It's an incredibly powerful piece of work about the infamous 1968 massacre of 500 Vietnamese people in the village of My Lai by American soldiers. The composer is Jonathan Berger, and also who we're having on the show today. And we're also featuring musician Van An Vo, a Vietnamese musician. And we're talking about, we're going to talk about that opera, all right? And I'll just give you a little thing, a little read from something that came with it from UCLA. It says, in an instant, a decision is made. The actions that follow pass without a second thought or may have consequences that last a lifetime. That moment may even alter history. My Lai starts from the fateful choices of Army Warrant Officer Hugh C. Thompson, Jr. on March 16th, 1968. He and his crew, Glenn Andriotta and Lawrence Colburn, flew in a helicopter over the Vietnam countryside. They witnessed American soldiers killing Vietnamese villagers, 500 women, children, and the elderly. And they exhibited extraordinary moral courage when they chose to step up and say, we're not going to allow this to happen. We're going to intercede. And when they failed to stop the massacre, they resolved to rescue as many civilians as they could and to never be silent about what they saw. Here to talk with us about this opera are the two of the people deeply involved in it, Jonathan Berger, the composer, and musician Van An Vo. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks, Michael. It's a pleasure.
Sure. And Van An, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
And my honor to be on this show.
Okay. Well, and I'm glad to have you here. So that makes two of us going good. All right. So let's jump into this. Jonathan, let's talk about what started this. What put you on the path of wanting to do a story about this particular, doing an opera about this particular event?
So I was I was 13, going on 14 when the My Lai massacre happened. I was 14 years old. Found out about it soon later when Henry Kam's article in the New York Times appeared in 1969. And it was in the context of a family with a father who was a World War II veteran and a great patriot and a brother who was a conscientious objector. And seeing the United States pictured in this way, and it was sort of framed my political being from then on. So it has always been an important event to me. It was much later, many years later, when I was teaching at Yale University, when a historian, Ben Kiernan, told me the story of Hugh Thompson and Larry Colburn and Glenn Andriotta. And there was something deeply moving about it. I mean, the story itself is beyond belief. I mean, to have Larry Colburn was then 18 years old. He was the gunner who Thompson had train his gun on American soldiers at a moment of absolute outrage. And I look at my students when I tell them the story, and I say, these guys were younger than you are now when they were put in this absolutely impossible situation. So it's a horrific story of genocide. And you know, let me say, I was listening to your show before, and I think I don't want to get into a polemic here, but Mikko Pellet's use of the term genocide is, I find, reckless and careless. This was a case of genocide. This was a case of American soldiers going in without any reason and wantonly murdering 567 civilians. And the aftermath of that was known because Hugh Thompson not only tried to intercede and stop it, but he refused to be silenced and suffered for it for much of his life.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of this being I mean, it's interesting. As I said, I have never seen an opera before in my life, and I was riveted to my seat, but also just blown away completely by it, and really spent a lot of time sort of wandering around and what I had seen and what I had learned. Basically, this point of just even scoring this, you know, it was so intricately done. You know, you scored for a tenor. The string quartet was there. You had Van An there with traditional Vietnamese instruments. What brought all that together for you?
So David Harrington, the first violinist of the Kronos Quartet, and I had spoken about this piece soon before we got underway. The history of the Kronos Quartet started by playing an iconic piece of 20th century music by composer George Crumb, a piece called The Black Angels, which was often seen as a protest against the Vietnam War. And so this was for the Kronos coming full circle. And we talked about the piece, and David gave me free hand, but he suggested strongly that I look into Van An's performance and work And the two of us, Von Ahn and I, got to work together. One of the richest and most wonderful musical collaborations that I've had. So the process, I'll turn it over to Von Ahn in a second, but I would say the process of putting this piece together was highly collaborative. The Kronos was greatly involved. Von Ahn was deeply involved in helping me learn the instruments and shape the process. Rindy Eckert, the singer and actor, and director Mark DiChiazza, all joined together. So it was really, you know, I take only small credit for this process.
Mm-hmm. Von Ahn, let's move on to you for a minute. Yep. What compelled you to take this on?
Since moving to the United States, I start to learn a lot about relationship between America and Vietnam. Because when I was born in Vietnam, grow up there, and moving to the United States until 2001. So everything that I knew about Americans and Vietnamese history, the relationship, you know, the Vietnam War, but we call American War in Vietnam, that we, you know, it's just the one side. And then when I moved here, I learned a lot about the other side and, you know, story and pain and scars and a lot of emotionals going on between in here as well. So I play a number of instruments, and I just told myself that what I could do is that I share the sound of my instruments and help people know about more about what it is really truly Vietnam and the pains as well for both sides. And so getting involved in My Lai, it is really it's very important for me. I should do it. I'm putting myself into that because it is very emotional, and the story of people that I didn't even know, but somehow I think that if their voices and their story, their pain, then could not be heard before, then maybe I can help through this contribution, and I can help them to be heard.
Mm-hmm. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with composer Jonathan Berger and musician Von Ahn Vo about the Kronos Quartet's opera, My Lai. Now, one of the things that you did that actually I found really interesting, I mean, it's look, there's an importance to what you bring to it musically, as you're saying, as well as historically in terms of including front and center the voice of the Vietnamese people, which I think is actually, you know, and I'm not talking about like, oh, you singularly, you know, concentrate the voice of the Vietnamese people, but it's actually hearing a voice that a lot of people don't hear in terms of speaking about that time and in a general way of doing it. That was important. There's also, I read somewhere where you made these instruments, and I was curious about this, that the instruments, some of the instruments that you played with, and I have to tell you, those instruments were incredibly beautiful, and what you did with them were incredibly, it was very, very powerful. And it took you to another place. It really did. It basically was a part of the entire opera that was sort of woven into it, but also stood out in our own right. And the instruments that you were playing, some of them were, I thought this was really interesting, gongs made from U.S. Army mortar shells and bamboo spikes that made up the xylophone that you were playing, the xylophone-type instrument. And they were the same kind of bamboo that the Vietnamese people used against U.S. soldiers in the war there. So, you know, let's talk about that. What brought you to that?
After the war, there's a lot of artillery shells and a lot of war articles left in Vietnam. So like my school bell made by a piece of B-52, the charge collector banged on another, you know, a piece of artillery shell. And we have bows and wash basin cut off from the artillery shell as well. So, and on the way to school, there's a lot of bunkers, individual bunkers that were there until early 90. So we didn't have much to start with. So we used a lot of whatever left over to make a lot of things, including instruments. So when I talk with Jonathan, and you know, it's this is the first time that we collaborate. with each other. So we talk a lot about sharing about thoughts, sharing about what I know, sharing about my you know, growing up in Vietnam, so that we have the understanding to help in shaping the peace. And when I share with Jonathan about what the bamboo would be used, and the and Jonathan thought that it was very meaningful, and I told Jonathan that the itinerary shell also had a great sound, and I actually used it in my previous production. To me, and I think that many musicians, when we, you know, all the army articles or war articles is so destructive, but then if you, you know, we try to use it and turn it into musical instrument to actually have to send a peace message or healing. And I think that is very meaningful, because that is what one of the few things that the power that the musician can do. And so we thought about that a lot. Okay. I mean, we here is Kronos Quartet, Jonathan and I. Mm-hmm. So we have to bring that into this production for that
And it was very well done on that. And Jonathan, I want to come back to you, because we have just a few, you know, we have like maybe 7 or 8 minutes left, and I really want to find this out. I really want to talk about this, because I was thinking about, there was so much we could talk about. We could talk about Rindy Eckert's work, which was just astounding. Harriet Scott Chessman's libretto, which was equally astounding and tied into the two. But there's a situation here that's related to this too, that basically Hugh Thompson spent all of his life, the rest of his life, fighting all this time, daring, because he dared to tell the truth and not back down. He refused to back down and say, okay, maybe I was wrong. Now, I read that your recent works deal with consciousness and conscience, and this is something that clearly marks this work as well, and the path taken by Hugh Thompson, and it's something that is really needed in the world today, I think. There's a need for people of conscience to stand up against the kind of rise to fascism, what's going on in this country, here, no matter what the consequences are to one's own safety. And I thought that the celebration of a man, a person who actually stood up and said, this is what I believe, it's right, and I'm going to fight for it. That was remarkably, and it is remarkably important in terms of everything that's going on today in the world today. Let's talk about that a little.
So I absolutely agree. I think Hugh Thompson was, and his crew, they were all remarkable. They were put in an impossible situation and at a split second made a decision that was ethically and morally correct, and then followed it up. Thompson testified against Cali and Medina and others soon after that, and he suffered continuously for it. We all, the ensemble, all had the huge honor of having Larry Colburn, the young, then 18-year-old gunner, who was put in this terrible situation of threatening to fire on his own troops in order to stop this genocide. And we got to know Larry in the last years of his life. He came to the first performance of the opera in Chicago, and it was incredibly moving. It was deeply, deeply moving. And it's, I mean, it's so easy to say how heroic these people were, but when you see the years of suffering and torturous lives they had with post-traumatic stress disorder, it really hit home.
Mm-hmm. Although I do have to say though, I think it's actually something that people really need to pay attention to, the morality behind this. And to the
Absolutely.
Fact, you know, so let's talk about that a little bit, mm-hmm. because I think that's important not to leave out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is, so there was a running piece in the throughout the opera in which doors recurred. So it was Thompson angrily yelling to open the door and let him out. And then there was this imaginary game show where doors were open, you know, behind door number one, behind door number two, and Thompson got drawn into it. And the reason that the door metaphor was important for me is because the musical material that drives the opera, there are really two pieces. One is this Vietnamese lullaby that Van An and I just fell in love with and used throughout. And the other is a snippet of an Iraqi Jewish congregation version of the very end of the Yom Kippur service, the Day of Atonement, where the door is being closed and you have the last moment to look inside yourself and say, what is moral and what is ethical and what should I do? So the door music is really sort of what drove this. And I think that really is the statement about the the three of them, about Thompson, Colburn, and Andreotta.
Mm-hmm. All right, I want to thank you very much for what you did, man, because I really, it changed a lot of my life in that, just in terms of
well, thank you for
what
being
I got
there.
To see.
Sure. I appreciate it. Thank
sure.
you.
And Van Ahn, thank you very much for joining us today and for the beautiful music you're playing.
Thank you.
Right? Okay. All right.
Thank
take
you.
Care now.
Bye, Van Ahn. See you soon.
Okay.
Bye. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We've just been talking with composer Jonathan Berger and musician Van Ahn Vo. And they were part, along with the Kronos Quartet, of an opera I saw last week called My Lai. And it's about the infamous 1968 massacre of 500 Vietnamese people in the village of My Lai by American soldiers. This month is the 50th anniversary of the massacre, which happened on March 16th, 1968. You can read more about the massacre in the American Crime series on revcom.us. There's a link to the article on my Facebook page as well. And I want to say this, folks. I want to say this. What was done there? What was done by the, you know, it's an incredibly important thing to never forget, what actually happened and what people need to do. When you're talking about Hugh Thompson, he saw what was necessary in the world and he stepped up and did it. He didn't hide. He didn't have any concern about himself. He said, I am compelled to do this because it's right, and we cannot allow this to happen. And that holds many lessons for today. When you look at the fascists in this society today and what they're doing around the world, this same kind of question is posed for all of us. So all of us got to be thinking about that. I want to thank everybody that participated in the show today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board offer today, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. That's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. All right, we're going to go out now with Troubled Times from Green Day. Couldn't ask for a more fitting piece of music for the times. Talk to you again next week.
What good is love and peace on earth when it's exclusive? Where's the truth in the written word? If no one reads it, a new day dawning comes without. Troubled times. We live in trouble.